aren't convinced by Turing's argument, but some are. Whether he was right or wrong, the Turing test is a useful mind game because it gets us to question many of the things we think we know about thinking. This Moment of Science comes from Indiana University. Today's program was prepared by William Oram, with help from David Leek in computer science. For A Moment of Science, I'm Yael Cassander.
In sports, Larry Brown is the new bench boss of the NBA's Charlotte Bobcats. It's the ninth NBA stop of the 67-year-old Brown's coaching career. He succeeds Sam Vincent, who was fired after going 32-50 in his only season on the job. Byron Scott, meanwhile, of the New Orleans Hornets, is the choice as the NBA Coach of the Year. New Orleans, San Antonio, and Utah will advance to the second round of the NBA playoffs tonight with Game 5 wins in their respective best-of-seven opening round series. The Hornets host the Dallas Mavericks, the Spurs are home to the Phoenix Suns, and the Jazz play the Rockets in Houston. Tonight's NHL playoff schedule has Pittsburgh at the New York Rangers, Dallas hosting San Jose, and Detroit playing at Colorado. The Penguins, Stars, and Red Wings hold 2-0 leads in the best-of-seven conference semifinals. The Chicago White Sox open a six-game road trip tonight with a two-game set against the Minnesota Twins. St. Louis plays the second of three tonight against Cincinnati in St. Louis. And the Cubs entertain Milwaukee tonight after a day off yesterday. That's sports.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from St. John's Catholic Newman Center. Since 1927, the Newman Center has served the spiritual needs and development of students, faculty, and staff through a program of prayer, study, and service. Learn more on the web at sjcnc.org.
As a result of the credit problems on Wall Street, many people who thought they had bought super safe securities, the so-called auction rate securities, are finding they can't get their money back when they want it. NPR's Scott Horsley reports.
When Flo Purnell sold her house in Washington, D.C. a couple of years ago, she needed some place to put the proceeds, about $350,000. Purnell, who worked for a time at NPR, was planning to move across the country, but not right away.
I wanted to put the money someplace that would be accessible, but I wanted a little bit more interest. I wanted something, you know, that made sense.
After talking with her financial advisor at Smith Barney, Purnell bought some auction rate securities that were issued by a mutual fund. She got a slightly higher interest rate than she might have earned in a money market, and she thought she could sell at any time. Ordinarily, the securities are traded at weekly or monthly auctions. As planned, Purnell moved to Los Angeles, got a job with an aerospace company, and earlier this month, she entered a contract to buy a house. When she went to cash in her securities for the down payment, though, her advisor told her she couldn't get her money out.
I was dazed. I was really blindsided by this. I wasn't hearing anything beyond, I can't do it. I can't execute the transaction.
And Purnell is not the only one who suddenly found a big chunk of her savings can't be touched.
Unfortunately, her situation is one that we're seeing playing out across the country.
Karen Tyler heads a National Association of State Securities Regulators. She and her colleagues have fielded hundreds of complaints from people in the same situation. She notes that investors were able to buy auction rate securities with as little as $25,000.
So this is definitely a Main Street America problem. We have, you know, the young couple whose home purchase down payment is tied up. We have the farmer whose spring planting is tied up. The small business owner whose operating capital is tied up.
State regulators are looking into whether those investors got adequate warning that they might have difficulty cashing out. A spokesman for Smith Barney couldn't comment on Purnell's individual case, but he says the company is actively supporting industry efforts to resolve the problem. The meltdown of the auction market in February caught many people by surprise. Bond specialist Eric Jacobson of Morningstar says for years, auction rate securities worked pretty much as advertised. There were plenty of buyers at the regular auctions, and if there weren't, the Wall Street banks themselves would buy the securities.
The dealers on Wall Street made it their business to maintain orderly auction markets. the mechanism worked pretty darn well for a long, long time.
By February, though, Wall Street's battered investment banks could no longer afford to buy unwanted auction-rate securities. And with the value of many other securities suddenly in doubt, Jacobson says ordinary investors got cold feet.
They just wanted to get away from anything that seemed to have the least bit of risk. Those things kind of feed on themselves, you know. Once there's a little blood in the water, everything starts to swirl.
The securities are still backed up by real assets, and they're still paying interest. But that's cold comfort to someone like Purnell, who can't sell when she wants to. Morningstar's Jacobson says it's a reminder liquidity can be an ephemeral thing.
It's kind of like the air we breathe. When it's there, you almost don't even notice it. When it's not, you're desperate.
Jacobson suspects the companies and government agencies that issued the securities will eventually buy them back from investors. In the meantime, Smith Barney's parent company, Citigroup, has offered to lend Purnell half the value of her securities so she can complete her house purchase. Scott Horsley, NPR News.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Lincoln Square Village in Urbana, the same square with a new angle, now with shops, offices, activity, and dining facilities, including Pretty Nails and Mr. John's School of Cosmetology.
You're tuned to the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. Plans to travel abroad? Do you need a passport? What are the requirements for obtaining a passport? These are some of the questions we'll take up in this portion of the program with U.S. postal worker Terry Prynne. He works at the Maine Urbana Post Office on Tatman Court, just west of Route 130. That post office is a passport acceptance facility, and Terry Prynne's duties there include helping us apply for a passport. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for allowing me to come on with you.
What documentation is required?
Proof of U.S. citizenship, which is a certified birth certificate, a naturalization certificate, or a previously fully valid U.S. passport. If the applicant is under 18, they still need to submit a birth certificate, and both parents need to come with them.
Okay. Now, what if an applicant's name has changed since the birth certificate was issued?
The certified document that changes the name, a court order name change, a certified marriage certificate, plus your IDs, must be in the name you're applying with.
Okay. Then what if my name has changed more than once?
The most recent.
Okay. And if I've been divorced, do I need to provide any kind of information in that regard with name changes?
You need to provide the name of each spouse you've had, the date you were married, your spouse's date of birth, your spouse's place of birth, the date the marriage was terminated, and the reason for termination.
Wow. Okay. That's quite a bit of information.
It gets tough for some people.
Yeah. Now, how long will it take before I have it in hand?
Right now, it's taking 4 to 6 weeks for the normal procedure. You can pay an additional $60 to the State Department, and they would expedite it. That time frame changes.
Okay. And you're a passport acceptance facility. So you take this information and then you turn it over to the State Department? Is that how it works?
We certify your application. We watch you sign it. We check your documentation. We try to make sure everything's filled out properly.
Mm-hmm.
Then I send it to a bank who cashes its payment, and then it goes to the State Department.
Okay. Now, how long is it valid?
A passport for somebody 16 and over is good for 10 years. Under 16, it's only good for 5 years.
Okay. Now, do I need to have a passport to travel anywhere outside the U.S.?
Right now, you do not need a passport to go by boat or car to Canada, Mexico, Bermuda, or the Caribbean. If you fly out of the country, you must have a passport.
Okay. Now, is this going to remain the case for the next year or two?
Until June of 2009, that'll be in effect. At that time, you might have to have a passport. And I say might because this has been going on since 2006. And every time the deadline comes up to get requiring a passport for boat or land travel to Canada, Mexico, the Caribbean, or Bermuda, they change it.
Okay. Now, I'm not planning on traveling to a country that requires a passport upon entry. Is there any reason for me to have a passport?
I think it's really important for people to have a passport if you have any family members who are traveling. If something happens to them out of the country, you want to get there. And You can get a passport in an emergency situation, but it requires a trip to a State Department office, the nearest which is in Chicago. If you have a family emergency, you probably are more interested in getting on a plane and getting there rather than just going up to Chicago and getting one through that way.
Yeah. Or who knows, the airfare might be great, and I think, I got a little time off here. I just might want to take off. What does it cost if I don't need it right away? What does it cost? What are the processing fees?
For an adult, it is a $75 fee to the State Department. For someone under 16, it is a $60 fee. There's also a $25 fee to the post office. That's where we make our money. It's called an execution fee.
Yeah. Well, you folks got to do the work. Makes sense.
We have to do the work.
Yeah, okay. Now, will you do a photo for the passport at the post office, and is there a charge for that?
We have a camera available, and it's $15 for a pair of photos.
Okay. And can I bring my own photos?
You can bring your own photos as long as they meet the standards that are on the application, which is overall a 2x2 overall picture, the head from the bottom of the chin to the top of the head, not more than 1 3/8 inches and not smaller than 1 inch. And the background has to be a plain white background. And you cannot wear anything that looks like a uniform, police, military, firemen. And your eyes must be visible. Sometimes people with glasses have a problem with the lights flashing, so they have to take their glasses off to get a good photo.
Okay. Do I need to make an appointment with you folks at the post office?
It's first come, first serve. We're not really that busy at the Urbana post office. Friday afternoons seem to be our busiest time, and people wait up to an hour on Fridays.
Okay, that was going to be my next question. Now, if folks want more information, if they're tuning in late, is there a website, or can they give you folks a call, or what?
The State Department has a website, travel.state.gov, and the Urbana post office is listed on page 12 in your phone book, the 2007 November phone book, and the number there is area code 217-337-6297. You could ask for me, Terry, or Ray, or just the passport guys.
The passport guys. Okay. Now, the hours out there on Tatman Court, what are your hours, Monday through Friday and Saturday?
We do passports 9:30 to 5, Monday through Friday, and 9 to 2 on Saturdays.
Okay. Very good. Terry, thanks so much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Terry Prin. He works at the main Urbana Post Office on Tatman Court, just west of Route 130. He's a U.S. postal worker. And that post office in Urbana is a passport acceptance facility. And Terry Prin's duties there include helping us apply for a passport. He's one of the passport guys. Again, thanks, Terry.
Thank you.
It's 2:54. Whizzing tires, whining engines, and booming car stereos are just about everywhere. Those sounds are a form of pollution, and they can affect the way we feel. Kyle Norris has the story.
The engineers at Chrysler are hardcore about noise. Right now they're inside a high-tech studio, and there's a car on rollers. The engineers are trying to pinpoint the noises that a driver would hear. Inside the cabin, it's pretty quiet. But outside, well, engineer Tanner Onze explains.
Outside.
Say that again?
This is a sound outside. So, see, I cannot communicate with you with this sound. So inside the car, this will be totally unacceptable.
Cars that are quiet on the inside are a huge selling point in the auto biz. But what about the sounds that a vehicle puts into the world? You know, like road noise. What are people doing about that? Not a whole lot. Story goes there used to be a federal office that dealt with noise. It was the EPA's Office of Noise Abatement and Control. But President Reagan shut that baby down in 1982, basically to save on cash. The idea was that the state and local governments could deal with noise. The noise office did a lot of good things just to help protect our ears. They had all these noise standards and regulations on the books. And the office was just a really good resource for state and local organizations, and also for people who were just having problems with road noise. But since it's been gone...
Well, a lot of the local noise control programs at the city and county level just dried up and blew away. It's hurt the noise program tremendously throughout the country.
That's Bill Bowlby. He's president of an engineering company that consults about road noise. He's also worked for state departments of transportation and for the Federal Highway Administration. He says that state departments of transportation are concerned about road noise, and that they're thinking about things like quieter tires and quieter pavements, and about not building residential areas near highways. But states are only required to do so much about road noise. For example, when states are widening or building highways and they're using federal money, which they almost always are, they're required to study road noise and to obey certain standards. But when it comes to road noise coming from an existing highway, it's totally voluntary if a state wants to deal with it. So you get a range of how different states deal with it, which they call retrofitting. Bill Bowlby says that although some states take the issue very seriously...
Other states have had little interest in the idea of retrofits, usually because they're looking to spend their limited amounts of money on highway-related projects.
And the kicker about road noise is that it can seriously, seriously affect people. For people who live near noisy roads, it can make their lives miserable. Plus, it can make it hard to concentrate as a driver and to hear the things around you like motorcycles and other sounds like sirens. Dennis Weideman is a guy who's thought a lot about all of this. He wrote his thesis about road noise. He says that road noise isn't dramatic or flashy, so it doesn't grab our attention. And road noise does not have a villain, so we're all responsible. Weideman says it can seem hopeless to people.
They know that they don't like it, but they don't know how it affects them. And if you don't know that, you just kind of get the impression that, well, it just bothers me. I'm weird. I'll let it go.
Noise experts say we need to reopen the Federal Noise Office, or something like it. And we've got to figure out how to make things quieter. This is starting to become a hot topic in the pavement industry, where different businesses are trying to one-up their competitors by making the quietest pavement. But for car companies, there's really no incentive to make cars that are quieter on the outside. And right now, there are no regulations of how quiet a car needs to be when it comes off the assembly line. Although that's not the case in Europe, where vehicle noise regulations are much more strict, and where the whole subject of road noise is taken a lot more seriously. For the Environment Report, I'm Kyle Norris.
The Environment Report is a production of Michigan Radio. Support comes from the Joyce Foundation, the George Gund Foundation, and USDA's Cooperative Extension Service. Have something to say about the Environment Report? Send email to feedback@environmentreport.org.
Earth and Sky.
Researchers are recovering the lost voice of the Neanderthals after 30,000 years of silence. Neanderthals were humans' closest cousins. Now, their vocal tract has been reconstructed. Here's Robert McCarthy, an anthropologist at Florida Atlantic University in Boca Raton.
What I and my colleagues did is to try to predict where the voice box and where the hyoid bone and the tongue would have been positioned in the throats of Neanderthals and other fossil hominids.
A computer synthesizer imagined how the Neanderthal E would have sounded. Compare that to our human E. That E is the difference between saying bit and beat. Neanderthals wouldn't have been able to voice that distinction, meaning their speech was likely less expressive than ours.
It might have been a little bit slower, it might have been a little bit more difficult to perceive in the sense that there might have been maybe more errors, but I think they could have had a very complex spoken language.
McCarthy hopes to simulate an entire sentence of Neanderthal speech. Although they were way ahead of Shakespeare's time, he would like to have the Neanderthals quote Hamlet, "What a piece of work is man." I'm Lindsay Patterson for Earth and Sky, a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Warden Martin Subaru in Savoy. Dedicated to preserving our planet, the Subaru Assembly Plant in Lafayette, Indiana, achieved zero landfill status with nothing from its manufacturing efforts going into a landfill. It's part of what makes a Subaru a Subaru. Information at wardenmartin.com or 352-8910.
This is WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Media, at Illinois. I'm Celeste Quinn. Henry Frain is our technical director. Coming up next here on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu, it's The World from PRI and the BBC. It's 3 o'clock Central Time.